And now we come to our next segment, which will be from the Balkan Anarchist Book Fair that was 2 weeks ago in Ljubljana. There were two comrades from the Anarchist Black Cross from Belarus, and they gave a presentation about the situation in Belarus right now and why the uprising there came to an end. And in the next probably 90 minutes, you can listen to them talking about the situation in Belarus.
2020 protests in Belarus, and you can remember there was a COVID pandemic at that moment. There is, I think they canceled it officially, but whatever. So why did they happen? So the problem was that at that year we had the presidential election campaign, and you should understand that the elections were stolen in Belarus for like ages. That's not the first time that the election results were falsified, and it's not the first time that people tried to protest, but it was the first time in recent history, I would say, where a lot of people got engaged and got politicized very fast, which was also a surprise for us. And we see the reasons for that are in the internal policy that Lukashenko was carrying out, but also in the fact that, for example, during the COVID pandemic, unlike in most of the places in the world, we didn't have the lockdown. We didn't admit there was such a thing. Like, there was the disease, but it's nothing. Like, we should go to work. We should, I don't know, hang out in the streets. There is no specific treatments. Doctors do not get any rise in raising the salary. Like, and this is why people started like to self-organize, and like they were like clearly they didn't like what was the government was doing and was like clearly lying to them. We didn't get the exact numbers of how many people died or got infected and stuff like that. And so it kind of touched everyone, and so some groups started self-organizing and like bringing protection for the doctors and stuff like that, you know, like bringing food to the old people, you know, like things that you might also see in your region. I think it's nothing extraordinary, but for Belarus, it was like the way that people could like talk about politics and like, I don't know, be discontent with the president openly, talk to each other and organize. So one of that was this feeling of, okay, I can do something, like not, instead of expecting something from the state. The next thing was that in this presidential campaign, we've got for the first time in years, I think, a few candidates that were not from the old systemic opposition. So the Belarusian state did a good job in like shaming the systemic opposition, saying they're all sold to the West, and like they all, and of course, some of them are, and we shouldn't trust them. But still, it's like people were not believing anyone in this political process, so people would rather not vote than like run after some candidate. So it was more like political alienation rather than like active support to Lukashenko or to any other. And this time it was a bit different because there were some new businessmen that tried to, like, not politicians but some business people, let's say, who said, I know how to rule, like I'm a good manager. And people like, yeah, cool, finally a good manager, right? And many kind of, so this protest was mostly middle class oriented, I would say. So many IT people got like engaged because they supported a specific candidate, NGOs, independent media and stuff like that. So it was not like specifically working class, I would say. And when I told you about the problems, like the mistakes that Lukashenko did, so previously, the best way you could prevent any of the demonstrations, any of the protests happening, you just don't let people meet. So you block the whole center, you don't allow them to be in one place. People are scattered, or people are being caught just in the neighborhoods. They get scared because they don't see the critical mass and they go back home. And in this case, Lukashenko tried to play a good guy, so he allowed in this campaign, so he put in jail all of these candidates, But the wife of them, Svetlana Tikhanovskaya, maybe you heard her name, so the woman, the face kind of this protest, let's say, the wife of one of them decided to go and like be a candidate instead. And because she's a woman, it's like, okay, let a woman run, like she means nothing, right? So they let her run, and there were some other women, like wives of other candidates and stuff like that. They created like a trio, and they let them gather the crowds. They let them make concerts. They let this woman go all around Belarus and like canvas. And people were like, cool, yeah, I want to see, like, and gather and see how many of us, like, and this is, I think, the mistake that the regime made. Like, people started realizing that I'm not alone in this, like, I want change. And also, what was interesting, that why so many people got behind that woman is that she said, like, I'm not going to be a president, like, I don't want power. I'm here just because my husband is in jail, and I'm, like, having five demands. First, like, set free all political prisoners. Second, like some change, some reform, whatever, new elections and stuff like that. So she wasn't like clearly saying, I'm not going to promise you anything. I'm not a politician. Like, I'm just here to like collect all of your energy, well, let's say, or like and stuff like that. So that means that she was not like the chosen candidate for the people. It was more like people went with her because she was voicing what they were thinking. What happened, get like this. So what happened after the results were stolen this time, all the country, like at the night of the elections, got, I don't know, some of the cities got set on fire. There was for the first time in some cities protests, and some of them were like a little bit violent, but more violent as a response to the police, because mostly, like I said, people were apolitical. They didn't know how to do any urban guerrilla or anything. They were like coming and seeing for the first time an armed cop or something like this, and they didn't know what to do. So, of course, there were some groups that were more prepared, like football hooligans who like wanted trouble, let's say, and or people who had also anarchists who like had a collective the experience of collective organizing, right? And so this happened, and people got clashed with the cops, and everything lasted for like at least for 3 days in the capital. Like every intersection was blocked, there was barricades and stuff like this, and people were like really, really in the streets until they made a like a lot of people were also detained. So it was like 4,000 people, 5,000, 6,000 people detained and like severely beaten, and nothing was known about them. And because of that, like people were hearing screams from the police precincts, like screaming clearly. And this is why people started like saying, okay, the cops get better and better in like suppressing this protest, like, and identifying where the intersections will be blocked and like coming there before and stuff like that. So people changed tactics, let's say, to, okay, we shouldn't be violent. Like, they got so violent to us, like, we should stop it from our side or something like that. This was the rhetorics. Like, it wasn't the discourse that everybody shared, but also the cops shared it and said, look, like, we didn't want to do this, you know? We were just, like, reacting. So please, let's just go back to normal. And this is where the protest took, like, a different form. And, for example, they started peaceful Sunday marches almost for 2 or 3 months, I think. And they happened first in every regional town, then only in Minsk. And these marches could collect, like, 500,000 people. But the problem with these marches were that they should be peaceful. Like, so in the first marches, even us, when we came in the masks, we were treated as provocateurs who like don't want to be peaceful. Why don't we want to put our Instagram pages, you know, like pictures of us and stuff like that? So we did a lot of work propagating against it, like saying that, hey, no, like this is not the end. Like, we have not won. Let's take care of our security. It's not about like provocateurs. Let's like in. So we were promoting the inclusion of all the tactics, but these peaceful marches were not like really ending anywhere. So people were hanging out for 5 hours in the center, and of course police couldn't stop them and didn't try actually, and they just guarded like the the buildings in like the administration buildings, let's say their residences and stuff like that. And that's it. People just went home, you know? Like, we showed how many they are, and they thought that dictatorships are falling this way. But also different kind of social groups, what was interesting, started self-organizing, started making chats on Telegrams. And we have seen, like, on Monday, there is, like, a disabled people march. On Sunday, there is a women's march. On Wednesday, there is a elderly people march. So it's like a lot of people started identifying as someone and joined their social group and tried to self-organize. And this was also confusing for the cops because, again, because of the sexism and also because of the, like, for example, at first they didn't know how to deal with women. They couldn't, like, beat them clearly, but then they started doing it anyways. Also with the elderly, it's like, first they cannot touch a granny, but then, yeah, I don't know, they choke in her. So it's like, it took some time for them to, like, adapt to this reality of who they can be violent with, and they were, in the end, with everyone. And so these marches kind of died down, but it was still an important clustering of the protest. The workers also joined the protests, and they, in many, so for you, you should understand that in, I think now more than 50% of the economy is owned by the state. So it's like the post-Soviet kind of heritage. Before it was more, but Lukashenko, even though he's being advertised as a socialist leader, let's say, or like post-socialist, he's not like that. He has been selling or closing down factories that were not profitable. And so the thing is that with these, so most of the big industries belong to the state. And so when these big industries who were used to be like loyal or thought to be loyal to the state always, they started protesting and they were like going from one factory to the other, calling fellow workers to join the march and stuff like that. And the problem with that was that, of course, not all of them joined, so it wasn't like a national general strike, but also that, like I said, the middle class, the IT workers, the people who work, I don't know, who go to coffee shops and stuff like that, there was never a day when everybody closed. Because they said, okay, it's like, because the economy is based on the workers, you know, like, so they are the ones who, like, pay so much to the budget. So why don't we, like, support them, give them money, bring them food, but let them just strike, and I'm going to work tomorrow, you know? So it's like, or I am, as an IT guy, just asking my manager to give me, like, a week off, and this is my way of striking, or something like this. So it was sometimes ridiculous, but in the end, so people were, like, pushing somehow or putting a lot of responsibility on workers for changing the regime while not really doing anything themselves or, like, expecting. And it was over because the management identified the most active workers. They fired them. I don't know, they harassed them, they intimidated them and stuff like that. So you want to add? Yeah.
But it was, like, even worse up to the extent that some factories would have like the riot cops at the entrance, and they would filter like the workers there, and the workers would be shut down, closed in their parts of the factory, so they're not allowed to leave the places where they were working. And that kind of like prevented also communication between the workers quite successfully between the different sections of the factories, and this also affected the further activity.
All right. So they died down, like nothing happened in this way. So there was some direct action, let's say, also. Like I said, there was this division or there was this like discourse about being peaceful, but also at the same time, a lot of people who previously never joined the protest, for example, I'm working as a post officer and I have access to people's personal detail, right? So I'm like damping that to a big blogger who then publishes everything about cops, where they live, which number of the car they have, and stuff like that. So a lot of people who worked for the mobile operators, like everybody who has access to personal details, secretly started helping the protest in this way. So we've got like several Telegram channels full of cops information and like calls for like go there and like destroy where they live, like intimidate them, these are motherfuckers and stuff like that. And it's a nice call, but because people never did it before, they went unmasked, like caught on every camera, or I don't know, talked to somebody they don't know completely on the chat and said, yeah, let's do it together, you know. So that was a big problem. Like most of these people were caught afterwards, and this is the big problem. And also this was used by the peaceful part to say, look, this doesn't work. It's like this intimidation only gets the protest more repressed, so let's not do that, let's like, I don't know, try diplomatic talks and stuff like that. What was interesting also, and for the first time, it's neighborhood assemblies and marches. So people started, instead of just going to the Sunday marches, they started like talking to their neighbors, creating chats, coming together with a few neighborhoods, getting to know each other and stuff like that. I've never seen like a meeting, like an assembly that would you imagine in an Occupy, for example, with a facilitated, you know, like, it was more like people getting in the center, the one who is loudest shouting, some people say, okay, I'm gonna do it, you know, or maybe we're gonna make a tea party. So it was never like saying, okay, we are the political group who wants to act together. It was more like whoever comes, comes. If not, like we do it with other people. And first they were open chats, but then of course cops infiltrated and they started targeting specific people and they closed the chats. So it was harder for a neighbor who didn't have any confidence or trust to enter. But we think it was important, and also anarchists participated in some of these neighborhood groups. And also some of us were like going around and trying to support them or like promote talks on different topics, trying to teach them security and stuff like that. And then when the Sunday marches got suppressed, the neighborhood marches, so it was like 2,000 people would gather in one neighborhood and march together to the center. So it was confusing for cops when 15 marches happening at the same time in Minsk. So, but anyways, these people mostly were not confrontative. Like if they met a cop line, they leave, like they turn. And this is how also cops were able to, I don't know, take some people on the way back home. So it's when it stopped being safe, because all these protests was advertised as being safe, you know, like let's come and it's nice, we want to be together. So as long as it stopped being safe for many people, people also stopped going. But some, of course, got politicized and to cut to. So it was mostly suppressed by February 2021. Cops found nice ways to deal with that. They dealt with the regions first. It only stayed in Minsk, and then they dealt with the center marches, and then they dealt with the neighborhood marches. And then they started going door by door, identifying people in the camera recordings, all those Instagram pictures that people posted. And so people understood, okay, I'm really fucked, like I shouldn't have done it ever because this is not what I expected. So what were the consequences? Shortly, we had 20 week... So 20 victims, and these victims not only include people who died, like for example, this person who was like just shot like 5 meters away from the cops, but also people who got like lost and never found, or lost and committed suicide in the forest during the protests, or also people who died in prison. There was a few political prisoners who were found dead, or also because of the COVID situation, and that was used as a weapon against prisoners. So many people who got to the demonstrations were later arrested, or like later or during the demonstration, if they were caught, they would put you for 15 days in prison. And so they would pack 20 people in one cell. If one of them got sick, they wouldn't isolate this person. They would actually like put more people, so everybody gets infected, and it becomes like a really, and no, of course, no medical care. offered. And so some people would got out and die like 2 weeks after just because of complications and stuff. So we think they are like, we count them as victims of that too. This number, I think now it's more because every day they add more and more political prisoners. So for you to understand, this month, like last month in June, there have been at least 90 trials registered. So it's 2023 and it's still going on. Like they still going door to door. And it's not stopping. And it's only the registered number of trials, right? So many people stopped reporting because they think being connected with the human rights organizations or somebody putting their name on online is something they would I would be punished for. So all independent media got shut down and declared extremist. So most of them are now operating from Warsaw, Vilnius, like all the neighboring countries. And the problem with them is also, or you could tell it in the legislation part about the following, like they stopped people from following and reading also. All NGOs shut down, so literally like 500 registered public associations were shut down for like being aligning with the enemy or like helping in some way or posting something about the protest and stuff. And also like here, it's not that we're caring so much about the businesses, but it was important to mention here that, for example, there was one day that was called a popular ultimatum or something like that, that when they said the whole country has to stop and like everybody who has to stop working on that day, and this way we like show that it's the end for us, you know, like we will not tolerate it anymore. So many bars, bookstores closed on that day, announcing like a sanitary day or something like that because they were too afraid to say I'm joining the strike. And so this created a lot of fines being put on them after by the authorities for like announcing this day without any permission or something. And also many bars and bookshops were places where people could like actually meet. Like in Belarus, there's no place like that. Like we can't publicly discuss political matters in any way. So why it was important that NGOs existed is that they sometimes provided space for people to meet, or that you could get into the bookstore and meet someone who shares your beliefs. So like clearing out the political space for discussion or for meeting was very important for this regime. The tougher legislation. Of course, we are going to mention only a few things here that we think are important or weird or funny even, like nothing, something that we never thought could happen. So in these three years, the most important thing that happened is the new extremist law. Of course, we had it before from 2008, I think, but it was never like a criminal responsibility. And for example, our website or the website of other anarchists were declared extremist, and it meant, okay, they could be blocked or they could be blocked on social media, you know, something like that. But it only applied to like us and a few more like ultra radical group like far right or something like that. Nowadays, it's like all media are extremist. And it's not only that they are, it doesn't mean that you cannot distribute their content, but also you cannot like even share it in a personal chat. Like you're sharing something to your friend, and then when you're getting detained, and you are getting detained at some point, the cops see it, they open your personal chat, it's not even public, and they see, okay, you shared it. Okay, good, 15 days in jail at least. So people started unfollowing the independent media, the bloggers, so they stopped following the content, the protest content, they stopped sharing it. And this was a big problem for us, like we cannot easily distribute what we think or what we think is important. Also, they criminalized solidarity because many solidarity fund has been created to help workers, to help repressed cultural workers, to help political prisoners. Like all of like people were really really donating, and then now it's called facilitation of extremist activity or financing extremist activity and stuff like that. So, and you can get 3 years in jail for like making a donation to some fund. And because many gave donations through the bank, so nowadays banks are given all the access, and you can clearly see when, how much, which person has done it. So, and also, they introduced a new form, which is not an extremist organization anymore. It's called an extremist formation, which is like a very vague thing. For example, if I am an independent TV channel, my formation is not just me, but also all of the followers who are like reading me on Facebook, you know? So it's like anyone can be someone if they want. And also, a lot of people are getting on that extremist and terrorist list. I think now it's more than 1,000 people who got already charged and convicted for extremist crimes. And they all, because many people left Belarus, right? So many people migrated. They also said, okay, so we will try you in absentia, and you get some years, and even though we cannot catch you, we're going to revoke your citizenship for like, and then you become a passportless person in some country, which can be a big deal. For now, they have just tried someone in absentia, given like 20 years or something. We haven't yet seen the revocation.
Talking about extremist formations, it's not like they are right now exercising that point that basically all the followers in Telegram of your, I don't know, very popular million chat like Nechta, for example, becoming automatically part of extremist formation. But the legislation is so vague that everybody can be included in it. And that means that everybody feels insecure about that, including like the people who are just following Nechta. They are not, they don't know if they are part of extremist formation or not. And extremist formation is something, as you might many know, kind of like a criminal organization law. But normally, criminal organization have to be defined, like there are certain steps that would make it a criminal organization and so on. Extremist formation is defined by the local police authorities. So they can just like say, this is extremist formation, this is extremist formation. That's why in Belarus, there are hundreds and hundreds of extremist formations, starting from anarchists and like anti-fascists, ending up with just medias or like human rights organizations. They're also considered extremist formations. And the law is not only about donating, but just being part of extremist formation is 5-6 years. Creating extremist formation, 5-6 years as well. A lot of comrades that are right now in prison, one of their articles is being part of extremist formation, although the law is kind of like now applied retrospectively. So if you were not part of extremist formation by the time you were arrested, and there was like a group in 2018 that they considered extremist formation in 2022, they will apply this legislation on you retrospectively.
Yes, everybody. Like, you don't have to be anyone, like, even without any political affiliation, literally.
It depends, still. Because there are some fascists that are pro-Lukashenko. And, like, some state propagandists are former fascists. And there were, like, reports of, you know, them Sieg-heiling in their youth days and so on. So those who are supportive of regime, it doesn't matter which colors you are great, you can actually get some screen time and so on. But if you are opposing Lukashenko, and some fascists started opposing Lukashenko after 2020, they're treated also like shit. Yeah.
Right. Then what's also interesting is that, for example, after the 2020, so the main discourse of the protester opinion is that we would like to Belarus to be sanctioned as much as possible, even if it harms the people, let's say, even if the people get more poor. Like, we think this regime has to, like, it can't go on forever with money. So if they cut the money or like export import thing, that so, and now, like, even being for the sanctions can mean 5 years in prison. Like, for example, one of our comrades just got 5 years in prison for like a Telegram post about inflicting harm to national security or something like that. And also, what's interesting, a new thing last year, they passed a new law about death penalty for attempted terrorist attack. So death penalty exists in Belarus until now, but it was used mostly for, like, I don't know, gang murder or like really, really atrocities, like horrendous stuff, or terrorist attacks. But because, and we will tell a little bit later about the war, about how people were trying to stop the war from happening. So these people were like doing the railway sabotage, and some of them, and like now all of them are considered terrorists. And some of them were detained even before trying, like before reaching that. And still the death penalty can apply to them just for trying or for thinking about that. This is how they try to like intimidate people from even trying, you know, like first you could think, okay, like even if I'm going to do it, I know I will be rotting in jail for 20 years. And now like, okay, so am I ready to die for it? You know, so it's like they raising the stakes for people so high that it's becoming really, really like existential question if you really want to be politically active in this country.
Very well. So, talking about repressions in general, Belarus is not an easy like political atmosphere where you do shit easily, openly, and so on. So we had a lot of repressions before 2020. We had a lot of repressions in the last 30 years. Quite often they were very blunt, just violence. There were some people killed in the past, like journalists and politicians in Belarus. But the scale of repressions in Belarus in 2020 changed completely the fabric of Belarusian society. It was not only like a couple of dozens or maybe hundreds of political activists and those involved in the political organizing who were affected by repressions, but rather like thousands and thousands, I mean, not thousands, but fucking hundreds of thousands of people in the country of 10 million, like even 9.5 million people. So it was like massive. You didn't have in family, like every family basically had somebody who was in one way or another affected by repressions. But there were also new things introduced that would actually address that attempt of a mass campaign of terror against the society, because you cannot actually like individually suppress the protest. You do need certain tactics that would make it even more complicated on a mass scale. And one of the things that was happening was that when people were getting arrested, the police would beat them up, torture, and so on, and then would force them to admit their guilt on the camera and say sorries. This is like what you see, I don't know, ISIS videos and stuff. And this was done with, I mean, dozens of thousands of protesters. There was a huge archive in the police with those things. And they were publishing those videos. They were publishing those videos in Telegram channels all around the internet, in the fucking YouTube, and showing like, look, those people are not like really serious. They're just bullshit actors and they're very easy to break and they're crying and so on and so forth. So for them, it was like showing that our terror is working, to terrorize also other people, to show we are going to fuck you up when we arrest you. But also partly when those messages were transmitted through the state media, like you could see this on the state TV channels, those videos during the news reports. And those were sending messages also to the Lukashenko loyal base to say, don't worry, everything is under control. Look, they are already like denying their participation or they're already saying sorries, so everything is going to be fine. The other part, of course, torture. Torture was used in Belarusian society for quite some time against the opposition, but also against, let's say, a more organized crime groups or the people who are exercising certain types of crime. So Belarusian prisons are a very violent place. I will be talking about in a moment. But it was not used, again, on mass scale against the population. In first days, as you were mentioning, 6,000 people were arrested, and those were also sorted out in three categories on how much torture will be applied to those people. They were like, you're just a normal person, you do not have any marking. That means you get like a light beating, you will get into the cell with 50 people and you will be standing the whole fucking night and so on. Then there was a yellow cross that would be like, okay, this is a troublemaker, we are going to beat them up and we are going to make them hard to, you know, forget this experience. And then there were red crosses that were put like on known anarchists, some punks,
maybe some football hooligans, and that meant there will be like as much violence as the cops would like to have with those people, and that meant that some people were, for example, leaving the police custodies only in the emergency cars. Some people were killed in the police custody and then were brought to the forests, and they were like hanged on the tree, completely blue, and then the cops said, yeah, they hanged themselves on the tree, that's not our fault. So torture became like normality in Belarusian society. It became like a shock for sure, but it became normality even up to these days. Like a lot of people who are thousands of political prisoners who are in prison are also going through the torture on a regular basis. So that's what you have to take in consideration when you're becoming politically active in the country, that you will be a subject of torture when you end up in the police station, when you end up in prison, and through your like life cycle of being an activist.
I wanted to add that because it's important that this picture is like of a comrade of ours, so it's an anarchist there, and it's actually the person who was in prison already for 5 years before he wrote that book based on his recollections. And the thing is that in the Belarusian society, also in the among the political kind of protesters, it's kind of fine to repent and to, like, if you're being tortured, people say, okay, it's okay if you're beaten, you don't have to, not telling on other people when you're tortured is fine. But for us anarchists, like, it's it hasn't been ever fine. So we understood that, yes, we don't know nobody knows our limits, but being an anarchist in Belarus is already means if you join our movement, it's gonna be harsh. So we are not accepting if you think you're gonna be too weak, so maybe don't join because it's a threat to all of us. And this case specifically was like why cops specifically targeted this guy, because he was like one of the one of us who was like propagating, emanating this like I'm not talking to cops, like I'm not breakable and stuff. And so this picture they were also showing to us, like saying, look at you, like you're so ACAB, so where is your ACAB now? You know, like a person crying, of course crying because of the tear gas, but it's like kind of humiliating. And also many of my like male comrades got quite intimidated after that because they realized, okay, the next is gonna be me. Am I going to like withstand that? And also it's not only withstanding torture, but also withstanding probably like expectation in our activist culture, right? So many people actually chose to leave, to not tell on other people rather than stay and be active.
Right. The other thing that happens a lot is pressure on the relatives. So the government starts applying the concept of collective guilt. If your son or if your brother is doing some political activity, it will spill on you in some way. You can lose your job, you can lose a place in the university you're studying, and so on and so forth. This is also not a new tactic. This was used for quite some time, since I think 2001 or something like that. Sorry. It became again en masse. It became again like intimidation for everybody, where people would like to distance themselves from anybody who is doing politics in their family or whatever. And this is also a situation for example, activists who are living abroad. They will be like pressed into conformity or being less public through pressure on their relatives. So some comrades are abroad, they are living for now in Poland, for example, but their relatives in Belarus, so their relatives can get arrested, their relatives can get tortured, beaten up, and so on and so forth. And everybody understands those risks while you're still politically active. Persecution of lawyers. This is another problem that is becoming like bigger and bigger in Belarus. The state controls the pool of lawyers. You get a license to operate under the state apparatus, and most of the lawyers that were politically active in the last years lost their licenses. Like I think we were counting 15 lawyers that we were working with from 2020 to 2023, lost the possibility to defend anybody. And here, for example, one lawyer that got arrested for leaking some information from a private case. But in general, this is, again, political prosecution of those that are not explicitly positioning themselves politically. Like the lawyers are not saying, I'm a fucking anarchist, I'm flying a black flag. but more like they are liberals, you know, that believe in the law and stuff like that, and that's why they go to the court and defend people and so on. But even that is already a problem because police starts understanding that the lawyers are also part of the chain of solidarity for those imprisoned. Right. So talking about situation in prison, for us it's a kind of a complicated topic because this is like very simple understanding because that's what we were living with for a very long time. But we got to know that people in the West do not really understand what prisons are in the East. Like not only in Belarus, partly it's also applying to Russia or to Ukraine. Those are like fucking horrible places, even if you think horrible places exist here. So Belarusian, in general, prison system was inherited from the Soviet times. We have this network of the prison camps that were part, like, they were not part of the Gulag system, but they are kind of like Gulag system. You live in the camp, you have a barrack where people are living in this barrack, and so on and so forth. That's where the major prison population is living. They have to go to work. And things like that, right? Then there are these prison houses in Belarus where people are kept in the cells, where you will be like kept 23 out of 24 hours, and then you have 1 hour of a walk outside. Walking outside in Belarus, it doesn't matter in which prison you end up, is like another cell, basically, that doesn't have a roof. So you have a cell 2x2, there is like a bars on the ceiling, and you can walk there as a to breathe some fresh air. And it's kind of like also important because a lot of people are smoking in prison, for example, and to get a little bit of fresh air is a fucking great experience. So stop smoking if you go to prison. So in general, like the conditions for the prisoners in Belarus is very restrictive. A lot of people are subjected to violence. So for example, Belarusian prisons are the training camp for certain types of the police forces, like the special police forces or the riot cops are from time to time go to Belarusian prisons to like exercise violence on the bigger crowds. And they are pretty open about that. So they beat up the prisoners to show how to use violence against the people and so on. But when you are a person who got arrested after 2020, so like so-called political prisoner, there is like just an extra layer to everything that happens in prison. Like the life is even more complicated to what is happening. One of the things is that Belarusian state restricts communication with the people in prison. So you are actually not getting any letters, any postcards or something like that to the prisoners. There are some ways that people do get messages, but in general, the only permitted communication per mail is with the relatives, so like maybe your father, brother, sister, mother, but that's it. So if you are, for example, were participating in some letter writing events for the Belarusian prisoners and you send some letters, then most probably those letters are not going to end up there. And I will talk about how you can actually solve that problem later. But that's an important part of isolation. So we did have a lot of comrades, not a lot, but a bunch of comrades who were actually asking why nobody's writing to them. Though they know that there is like this massive censorship, they were still like very desperate for communication. And that was like a fucking heartbreaking, you know, because people are isolated quite often in a solitary confinement and do not get any letters, any communication with their comrades. Plus, people are not getting any money from outside. They cannot use the money in the prison shops. And prison shop is a very kind of important part of the prison economy because the food in prison normally is shit. So you, if you want to get something on top of that, you do have to buy from time to time some things from the prison shop to keep yourself healthy. Otherwise, you will just, like, your health will degrade so fast that you are fucked within a couple of years. And then visitation in Belarusian prisons. Who here in the room ever visited a prison, someone in a prison ever? Just raise your hand. Roy, okay, it's a good group. You did a good job. This is an exemplary. The thing is that in most of the countries, and I think that was your case, you didn't visit your relatives, you can actually visit people you know, you can, if people are asking for your visitation and so on. So the scale of the people who can visit the people is very big. In Belarusian prisons, only your close relatives can visit you. So again, your father, mother, brother, sister, or a husband, wife. only those people are allowed for visitations, and they, depending on your regime, like, so there are different regimes of prison, depending on the regime, this can be like once every 3 months, so every, like, you get 4 visitations per year, and then if you are like the stricter and stricter regime, you can get 3, 2 visitations and so on. So visitations are very limited, and very limited to the certain group. So if you're bad with your relatives, most probably you won't get any visitations at all. And what happens to the political prisoners is that those visitations are taken away as part of the pressure point, as part of the pressure program. So a lot of comrades are not getting visitations from their relatives. Instead of that, they're actually put more into prisons, and that's into isolation, and that's part of, again, putting pressure on the people who are sitting in prison even further, and the struggle that goes through the people. And this is also connected as well with the packages, the parcels, food parcels, clothing, and so on. Those can be passed also only 3-4 times per year, limited weight, and also those packages are taken away quite often, including like medical packages, if you have like special health conditions, and so on and so forth. And this is like a huge attack, basically, on the just the leftovers of solidarity that can be brought from the outside to the prisoners. Then it is quite common that if people are even ending up in the prison camp, they will be transferred to the high security facility later on in their prison term. So that's what happens right now to the anarchists in Belarus. A lot of them are passing through like an extra step, and they are transferred to the prisons where the conditions are a little bit more harsh, and in general, like the treatment of those prisoners are like very fucked up, because they are like special prisons that are built up to break like an organized crime bosses and shit like that, and that's where our comrades are ending up. And even if you are ending up in this prison and the things are very harsh for you, there is still one extra layer, an extended punishment cell. This is like an a solitary confinement cell, which is like, maybe you've seen it in popular culture. You know, they throw you in this concrete shit, and that's what happens to you. In Belarus, it's a little bit more sophisticated. Again, we inherited that from the Soviet times, and the Soviet prison regime was a fucking disaster. Like, it was basically learning through years how to make people more miserable and how to destroy human lives even more successfully inside of the prison. And the solitary confinement prison is, again, also like a concrete cell, sometimes with the wood on the floor. There is quite often no heating in those cells. So in the winter, it gets very cold. It gets so cold that you cannot sleep, actually. You have to constantly move. You do not have any benches. This is like the flipping bed that goes up for the most of the time of the day. So you have it only for 8 hours, from 10 in the evening till 6 in the morning down. You do not have mattresses normally and stuff like that. And it's a sort of a torture of its own, right? Like, one of the comrades that was sitting in the solitary confinement in the winter, he was describing it in the way that, yeah, I could sleep like 15 minutes, then I do 20 minutes workout or 30 minutes workout, then I can sleep 10 more minutes in the night, and then this is repeating, right? Just imagine you are like, you've been cold in your life once upon a time, right? Imagine that is like permanent state for 15 days. You are cold constantly. There is nothing that can warm you up. You're just basically, the only thing that can warm you up is your fucking will to live, you know? And those are the things that people are going through like on the regular basis. The isolation cells, the solitary confinement in many prisons is overcrowded, and you get a queue. So people are queued, like, you know, you got like 10 days in the solitary confinement that you must probably will wait for next 30 days, because there are already people who have to be there. And there are like these comic situations where people are getting kicked out from the solitary confinement because the other people have to go to the solitary confinement, and they can do their solitary confinement in 15 days later. So like this practice is used en masse. It's not only used on anarchists or some like hardcore political prisoners, but used on everybody who is considered to be political. Yeah, and the other part is that a Belarusian Belarusian prison regime started also color labeling or labeling the prisoners. Some of you might have seen this again in the popular culture during the Nazi times they had in their prison camps. In Belarus, they started in 2014 with like extremist and terrorist prisoners plus drug abuse or drug users who ended up in prison. Those had like different tags. And from 2020, it extended to like this massive, it's basically exploded to this massive amount of people who were prosecuted for participation in the protests. They get this yellow label, this is like extremists, and the yellow labels mean that you get like an extra treatment and it can easily be identifiable by the prison guards who are the political prisoners. A lot of yellow labels are not allowed to communicate with each other depending on the prisons. Like there are prisons where you are not allowed to do that, and also prisons where the general prison population is not allowed to talk to the yellow labels. So you get like complete social isolation. You are living inside of the prison, but nobody is allowed to talk to you, and the punishment is going to the solitary confinement or being kicked out to the prison, like a closed prison facility. Yeah, that's what I mentioned. All right, war in Ukraine, right? This is a huge topic, and we can talk about it, I think, for hours and hours and hours, and if you want to discuss about it, we are at the table. It is something that is affecting us a lot because we are, as an anarchist, do not know borders somehow, and a lot of people who are in Ukraine are our friends, brothers, sisters, and so on. So this war affects those we know, but it also has a huge implications on how the situation develops in Belarus itself. What does this war mean for us, and how Belarus will be looking like in the next 2-3 years will depend on how war develops as well, right? When the full-scale invasion of Ukraine started in 2022, Belarusian society was going already for 1 year and a half of this like hardcore repressions. There were, I think, over 70,000 people who left the there were beyond 200,000 people who left the country in different directions. Some went to Ukraine, some went to Lithuania, to Poland, and so on, some even to Russia. And so the society was already under this constant press, and we didn't expect anything big to happen. But the war like just basically spills from the Belarusian border, and actually thousands and thousands of Belarusians go on the streets. Like suddenly you get all these people who were persecuted, who are under fear of being prosecuted, they go on the streets. And in the first few days of the protest against the war, there are, I think, over 1,000 people detained. And those 1,000 people, just to understand, and it's different between Belarus and other places where the protests were happening, in Belarus, those people went to prison. Those people went to like 15 days in prison. Many of them were tortured. So everything that I was talking about before, like the repression apparatus and so on, those methods were applied to those people who were participating in that protest. That's why, like, although the protests were there and the people were trying to stop the war, the uprising didn't spill into like something bigger, and also like it didn't explode in Russia. So I think for Belarusian society, it was like a huge downer, and a lot of people stopped protesting. So like the risk of just going on the street and stopping this war, the possibility of stopping this war was not basically enough to make any difference, because at the end of the day, although Belarus was participating in the war, I think for a lot of people, like you can't stop the war through influence on Lukashenko or some other people. But at the same time, I would do the next slide. But at the same time, like those people who couldn't participate anymore in the protests on the streets, they thought, okay, we're not going to stop. Like this is not our way. We are politically involved, we are active people, we do believe in changes in the society. So some people turned into the railroad sabotage. This is like the most famous thing I think everybody knows or heard about from Belarus, where people were destroying like parts of the railroad. It was not like they're coming with a fucking saw and destroying the railroad, right? The modern railroad is a very digitalized infrastructure, so there is a lot of like electronics, and it's very expensive. So they were destroying that electronics that was responsible for, you know, doing the automatization of the railroad, and it was very successful. The idea was to paralyze Russian troops that were transported through the country, and it worked to a certain degree. Where some optimistic people are saying, that's why the Russians failed in Kyiv. I mean, for sure, partly, yes. And for sure, like, there was a lot of anger. And that's why there was a lot of, like, pressure from Moscow to Minsk to stop that from happening. And that's why there was this law passed that would actually introduce death penalty for sabotage or attempts of a sabotage. And to this, I think within a week, it's escalated where the cops started shooting people. Not deadly shooting, but for example, here you can see a person who was detained in attempt to do the sabotage. But then the cops on the video, on purpose, like, shot him in both legs to show, like, to the rest of the people who are doing that sabotage that we start, like, using firearms against you. So take the fuck care about that. And it worked in some extent. The level of, like, sabotage on the railroad decreased dramatically. And in general, by now, so summer 2023, we do not have, like, a massive resistance against the war in Belarus. There are still, like, smaller groups that are doing certain sabotage. Like, there was recently this big news about the Russian intelligence airplane that was damaged in Minsk. And things like that. So people do some certain small actions of sabotage, but a lot of people would do that action and leave the country because, like, for doing these things, you can get killed in Belarus very easy, even after being arrested officially by the cops.
I just wanted to add that right now, like, we could only see personal, let's say, disgust or personal fight, let's say, against the war or the symbols of war. So, for example, you could hear stories sometimes a taxi driver refusing to drive a Russian military and then getting punished for that. You could see a story about somebody in the, like, in a, not in a village, but like in a smaller town, damaging the car with Zeds that is sometimes driving in the streets in Belarus. So, and this person, of course, got detained recently. So some people would write comments against war and then get like 2-3 years in prison for like comments and being against the state or something like that. So and also I think one of the most important projects right now is the project started by some blogger where they are trying to use the crowdsourcing information about where the Russian troops are stationed in Belarus. So it's like they are making it visible, and so people are sending them pictures, people are sending them pins, and they are like announcing, they're following where the planes are going. And I think this channel is also used sometimes by the intelligence in Ukraine to like identify. So it's like the only way for the people in Belarus to be against war right now is like secretly doing something or some smaller damage, because nobody believes that a critical mass is a way to do it. You want me to do the next slide? Okay, then I will stand.
No, sorry.
Yeah. Okay. So this is the new story, right, of Lukashenko and Prigozhin. Lukashenko, who saved Prigozhin as a rioter, yeah, rebel Prigozhin, right, who tried to attack Moscow. Okay, this is funny, but not so funny for us, right, because all these people are now in Belarus, stationed somewhere, and I don't know, just probably looting, attacking women, or whatever they are doing in their normal lives when they're not fighting. So what's important to say about Lukashenko here? So clearly, Belarus is part of this war. And clearly, the fact that Belarus is not part of Russia, like even though objectively it is already, some people like to call it an invaded land because it's like an occupied land, because we cannot say that there is a separate authority anymore. So it's more like Chechnya, where they have Kadyrov, but Chechnya is part of Russia while Belarus is still not. And why is it? So you have to understand that Belarus and Russia has been a union state, something they called a union state, for 20 years now, I think. They always tried to like amalgamate, but they never did. And everybody thought it was because Lukashenko was so stubborn and so cool. But my opinion is that it's just very convenient for both of them to not be one state. For example, if Russia starts the war, all the sanctions are targeted against Russia. But not these sanctions are not touching Belarus, because Belarus is not a full player in this. So this means that we still can export all the goods that Russians need or import. We still can have McDonald's, Lay's, whatever, H&M's that got closed in in Russia, or like all the chips, all the mechanics, right? They could go through this country. So it's cool that they are not one country, because Russia can also like identify, okay, look, if Lukashenko does this in Belarus, this is how we see the international reaction. So it means that if I want to do something like that in Russia, I can either go with it because their international reaction was shit or not good enough, or I'm like checking if I want to do it. So for me, it's like they have this duo that is, of course, Lukashenko is trying to use his position as a buffer zone between the West and the East. And actually, you don't need to like invade Belarus because it's already almost the same or even worse than Russia. Because we think that basically many of the policies, many of the repression tactics that were used in Belarus in 2020 are now used in Russia with the same efficiency rate or even more. So right now, it's not like it's basically like a test lab for the regime, for the Russian regime, and. The problem with Lukashenko is also that, for example, Zelensky or the government of Ukraine is trying to play with him, like trying to kind of be a little bit harsh, but also like not closing completely the diplomatic relations because they want him to be a little bit on their side. And this is why it's also very, we see it very, like a double standard, let's say, because the government was accusing Belarusians for doing nothing against this war, like the Ukrainian government, and like not really acknowledging this opposition leaders that we will talk a little bit later, who are against war, who are trying to do and like who are trying to get the attention of the Ukrainian politicians, but they still like abstain from meeting them. They still abstain because they understand that as soon as they do it, Lukashenko will like move completely and side with Russia. And so what's important is that it's now become like a little bit like an Australia for the UK, where you could send the criminals, right? The people that you don't like, and it's the land where somebody will take care of them without like disturbing the general Russian population and stuff like that. And so basically Belarus is like a resource hub for Russia, and they enjoy that position, like the government enjoys that position. What's also important is that, and we're going to talk about it a little bit later when we will tell you our position on that war, but the thing is that Belarusian state or like Belarusian regime, we think it's getting more and more fascist features. And a few of them are the merging of state and society. So it's like if you can't be part of the state only if you're loyal. So if you're disloyal, we're gonna like destroy you as a society. This is what also like happened and is still going on. So if you're against the regime, you're like against the whole thing, the whole Belarus, the whole system. So you're like not one of us, and you're gonna be exterminated or suppressed. Complete control of cultural media sphere, that's already happening. Also the militarization of the governmental positions. So right now Lukashenko has passed a new constitution where if he dies, after the protests he got a bit scared, so if he dies, the new military council will take over. So it's like 10 people from KGB, military in some ministries and stuff like that. So they will take over immediately. And we don't know who's gonna be worse, this council or Lukashenko, but anyways. Now the deans, the rectors of universities are getting fired, and the KGB agent is put against on top of a university or as a main doctor of a hospital. So any state institution is being headed more and like increasingly by people who collaborated or like clearly supporting the regime or like the ideological workers of that regime. Because what's happening now is they are making the cleansings inside this state institutions, so they are literally forcefully taking phones of people, checking each phone and all the chats, and if you're like disloyal or getting fired immediately from school, from hospital, from like, I heard the news also, they started like in the trains, in the passenger trains, they sometimes put like a riot cop squad that can like approach any and tell, okay, let me see your phone. If you don't give it, then you're even more suspicious. And so now it's like, for us, it's clearly like a fascist regime already. And this is why it's important to understand that it's not just, so a lot of people who are telling about this rhetoric of like NATO against Russia, let's say in this war, and saying like we should like say none of them is good, like we shouldn't support the side, we should like abstain exclude ourselves from this discussion. For us, it's not only the militarist perspective, it's also the, like the existential and ideological perspective. It's not like the just the two kind of equally politically minded powers that are fighting. For us, it's like clearly like we have left a fascist state and our relatives have to live there. And like we do not accept more years of that, and we do not want this to come to Ukraine, you know? So you wanted to comment? Okay, you want to take the next one? So like, this is Lukashenko, right? But also there is like this opposition part, and we will tell you just a little bit how they reacted and what, how they try to get political points on that war too.
So, I already told you that there were some people who migrated from Belarus to Ukraine between 2020 and 2022. So when Russians like went completely full scale through Belarusian territories, a lot of Belarusians ended up with a choice. Do I leave again and I go somewhere else, or I do something where I am? And a lot of people left, a lot of people went to Poland, but a lot of people stayed. Some of them joined like voluntarily groups that would provide humanitarian aid, would provide relief aid, and so on and so forth. Others joined the military. Others joined like volunteer formations and so on and so forth. And slowly, step by step, Belarusian fighters started getting their own military units within the Ukrainian army. And one of the biggest ones you might have heard is Kalinovsky unit. And the people who went there are not the people who had like a strong ideological belief, you know, I have to join the army to fight and I am, I don't know, an anarchist or I am an anti-fascist or a fucking fascist, whatever. Rather, a lot of people had very, how would you say, existential need to fight, because that's the fight we lost already in Belarus. And in 2020, there was a threat that Belarus will be invaded by Russia. The Russian National Guards were already standing at the borders in August between Belarus and Russia and waiting for, you know, like a go from the Russian state, but it was not required because the regime actually managed to take care of it. So for a lot of Belarusians, this was not only Ukrainian fight, but it was our fight, like Belarusian fight. We were fighting with that authoritarianism just a couple of years ago. It smashed, it killed some of us, so we have to fight back. And unfortunately, by the time the units started forming up, most of them, in one way or another, went under control of the extreme right, of the Belarusian extreme right, who were there already for more years, and they had more experience with the weapons and with the military. So right now, the Kalinovsky unit, and there is also Belarusian Volunteer Corps, those are the groups that are politically formed up by the fascists, and the fascists are trying to use them to gain their political power as well within the Belarusian diaspora, within the Belarusian society as the fighters of freedom. But also the amount of those people in those units is very limited. I mean, Belarusian Volunteer Corps is a clearly fascist unit, but inside of the Kalinovsky, the amount of the people who are fascists, who are controlling this political narrative, is very limited. And a lot of people who are fighting in that unit are just like, they can be liberals, they can identify as anti-fascist and so on and so forth, because at the end of the day, for Belarusians, there are just a couple of Belarusian units where you can go. There is an attempt to depoliticize the fighting unit in Ukraine through another, like I will show you the guy, through another political unit that will be more liberal and less like right-wing radical and will be more associated with Tikhanovskaya, but this is more on the way. And and I think like it's very important to understand that for a lot of people who went to fight in Ukraine, it was very clear that if Russia wins, we all, like, Belarusian diaspora is just, you know, we can drop the weapons, we can just drop everything and just fucking give up and live our miserable life till we fucking die, because there will be no positive agenda for the next generations to come, as the Russian state will continue to expand. Like, if the Russian state wins, it will continue to try to win even further and further and further. So for a lot of people, the destruction of the Russian state or loss of the Russian state in this war is an essential step towards, like, the liberation of Belarus. If Russian state exists as an authoritarian regime, there is very little chance that it will actually give possibility for Belarusian society to be free. So yeah, that's the case. And also some of the Belarusian anarchists and some of the Belarusian anti-fascists went to fight in Ukraine, who were there or who joined later, and they are on the front lines right now. And in general, Belarusian diaspora is one of the biggest, like, fighter, like, international fighters inside of the Ukraine right now. Even though the country, as I was mentioning, is like 9.5 million people, it creates, like, one of the biggest military internationalist groups in the military. Talking about the Belarusian opposition, since 2020, the narrative changed a little bit. Belarusian opposition was more like a liberal, hey, we should be, like, civic in the way we are approaching Lukashenko and blah, blah, blah. But with tanks rolling through the country, this narrative kind of, like, very clearly flipped to the point that, yeah, we have to burn those fuckers and, like, burn those tanks, destroy that that military presence in the way. And, of course, like, in the first months of the full-scale invasion, a lot of people were rallying to collect money, to pass those resources further to the Ukraine, to the Belarusian people, but also to the Ukrainian people to fight back. And slowly the narrative was changing. And of course, because the narrative is changing, certain people are dropping out and certain people are moving in. And here on the picture, you can see, this is like a United Strategic Cabinet, Transition Cabinet. I mean, they were creating this opposition bullshit formations for very long. So this is one of those. But inside of it, we have, I think, three people at least, or four people who were connected with the regime before, apart from Tikhanovskaya. Tikhanovskaya was not connected with the regime. But the guy on the left was a diplomat of the Lukashenko in France. The next guy is head of one of the departments of the political police who flipped in 2020, and so on and so forth. And this guy on the right is a former military airborne unit colonel who was in Brest by the time the protests were. And he is now the person who is trying to organize this kind of, like, apolitical or liberal military unit inside of Ukraine. They are not great people. You have to understand that those people who were inside of the Belarusian regime for so long, they didn't have opportunity to become liberals or anarchists in the best case. No, they are the people who have very, like, authoritarian perspectives on how the world should work. They are just unhappy with the way the things are, and they are not in power. So we do not expect them to be to become, you know, like, the engines of the changes inside of the Belarus, but rather people who will grasp to power as soon as they have a possibility when Lukashenko is gone. But they are also the people who are promoting this, like, okay, the non-violence way is not working. We actually have to continue pushing further to make changes in Belarus. Yeah. You want to do this, or should I do this? No. Okay, so in general, as for, like, the anarchist movement, the Belarusian anarchist movement, the war is a fucking horrible thing. It's not like we are running around and saying, yeah, war is great, let's do some more wars. War is horrible. War is suffering, and it's destruction, and it's a rise of reactionary ideology, and I mean, you all know that. But at the same time, we see this war as one of the conflicts of the societies that will bring changes. It doesn't matter if we want it or not, there will be changes coming. They are coming during the war, they will be coming after the war, and we believe that we are, as revolutionary anarchists, as people integrated in the society who are fighting not for our own freedom, but for the freedom of the others, as well as ours, we believe that we have to be integrated into that fight, we have to be part of that fight, to be able to influence any changes in the future. And I think it's not going to be a surprise to say that there will be not so much saying for the people inside of Ukraine or even inside of Belarus who decided to ignore that conflict and said, okay, you should have run away, you know, and that was our solution. No. Actually, we believe that through this conflict that exists right now, we as an anarchist, anti-fascist, we have to conquer our space in this war. We have to conquer the space that will be used for those political changes, that will be used for social changes in the future to come. We have to become strong as a political organizers to make those changes possible. And that's why we support our comrades that are fighting on the front lines, that's why we support our comrades that are organizing humanitarian relief aid, and it doesn't matter which flags they're flying, whether they're Ukrainian anarchists, they're Belarusian anarchists, they're Russian anarchists that are fighting there. And for us, this is the struggle of our fucking life. It's a continuation of the struggle we had in Belarus. And I think it is very important for us to mention it here because all those things, those repressions and things like that, it's not like we are trying to become victims. This is part of our struggle. Our struggle is not the poor fucking anarchists that are suffering through the whole generations. No, we are the anarchists. We are revolutionary anarchists that are fighting for freedom. And this war is part of that fight. Of course, there are different different people who are fighting in that war, but we believe that as an anarchist, we do not have any right to not participate in that. We actually have a duty to stand with the workers together in the fight, with the workers who do not have any choice as well. They cannot run to Poland. They cannot run to Germany. This is individualistic choices. We believe that as a collective people, we have to stand together with the others.
I just wanted to say that it's important to understand that we see Russia, like Russian regime, as the gendarme of the revolutions in the region. So it's like as long as there is this regime, there is not going to be any change. And for us, like if Putin wins on any level, so he stays in power, if his regime stays in power, it would mean literally no space for anarchists, neither in Russia, nor in Belarus, nor in Ukraine. If he loses, we can see. Yeah, it can be a fatal failure. Yes, we can see the PKK, the Kalinowski unit, fascist management going back to Belarus and trying to install their own junta. But we would prefer that to 26 plus years of Lukashenko without any change and with like, so we would like to see the change and react to that instead of just saying, okay, let it be like that, we can't change anything, and we just want to live. So basically, we have like a brochure, which is ABC Belarus position on war, but also I'm part of the group of Belarusian anarchists in Warsaw. And we made a longer text on it. And what we think is that what we as anarchists in the region needs to do is like to stop this war, but each region, each country has to do it in their own way. And first, yes, if you are in Russia or if you are a Russian anarchist, yes, do everything possible to stop your troops from advancing. Sabotage, blow up, burn the conscription units and stuff like that. If you're in Belarus, do everything possible to stop the Belarusian army to join. So whatever ways you can do it, we told you it's not so much that people can do in Belarus. So it's not easy there to operate or to sustain that goal. But if we see any initiatives from inside, we would like to support that. But if you are in Ukraine, the best thing we think is to fight that troops from advancing. So this is why we want to stop that war, but we don't see this as we don't like the defeatist position. And we understand that the end of this war will mean a lot to us. Either we're staying here in a limbo forever, talking to you about Belarus and how fucked up it is, and then also talking about the whole region and how fucked it is, or we can return and make some changes. So this is, if you want to read more, like there's more like argumentation in this text, it's downstairs at our stalls. We are running a bit late. I'm going to wind it up, just coming back a little bit to our prisoners, right? Let me just do it. So anarchists in Belarus, are there any? Of course. at least the biggest group is in prison right now. And also downstairs, you can take a poster where we feature all of them. You have to? You have to. And please bring more to where you are coming from and like spread them and post in your social centers. And they have like a donation QR code and stuff like that. So what else? ABC Belarus, yes, we still exist. We have some problems also because many of our comrades ran away to different countries. There is not so much of a movement left, let's say, that we can interact with. And the problem is that people just start living their lives, you know? So we've got people who have 20 plus years here on this list. And we are the group that is seen sometimes as a specialized aid force that is going to stand for these people for 20 years while the rest of the people will study, work, forget their anarchists. And I mean, like, the expiration date of the anarchists are usually like, I don't know, 3-4 years, right? Everywhere. So we shouldn't expect people going for a long time, but it's just something that is painful for me, understanding that these people thought more people will stand up for them, even if they're in prison. But unfortunately, it's not like that. So what we are trying to do right now is like collect money for these guys, trying to talk to their families and find lawyers for them, and also trying to talk to our comrades around the world to like still like attract the attention, because we understand that things are changing. Like, the protests happened in 2020. It's been 3 years. Like, people forgot and it stopped being a priority for them. So we are trying to make it a priority still for people. There is a pramen.io, like a website, a media collective that is creating content mostly in Russian, but also there is a big English section where we are trying to publish, not we are trying, these collective is trying to publish important information that they think is good for the foreign people to know. And for example, I was telling you about the protests, and there, like, it's either on the website, but also here on the stalls, like a very long brochure about our analysis of the protests, our own mistakes. So if you want to learn from our experience, please make sure you take them. And like I said, I'm part of this group of Belarusian anarchists in Warsaw. What we're trying to do is that we're trying to work with the diaspora. So we think that people who left and mostly still politically active in Warsaw and trying to organize against the regime, we would like to make this group, like, let's say, our target audience, because if we all come back together, it's important for us that these people will be more sympathizing with us than with liberals or with the right wing. So we are doing a lot against nationalism, against the militarization of the opposition, which we see as like the belief in the strong hand, that changing women for all, for guys who are from former militaries and stuff like that. So we are trying to be critical to about all these trends. And like, actually, we are also like against this riot porn that is happening right now, for example, with this Kalinowski unit, right? Where people are like, they cannot do anything, like they like to look how somebody will free them, you know, like they like to follow it online and send the money for somebody dying for them or like fighting for them and stuff like that. So we also see this as a very problematic issue, that people should not give power to any of these political units that are trying to also politically benefit from the war and from the amount of power they're getting. And just a few pictures for you. So you can see that some of these people are getting like from 3 to 5 years. For example, one of these guys, like on top, oh, I cannot show you, but right top corner is someone who didn't, like, we didn't know him, but he identified as anarchist in jail. So, and like, we got information about him from other comrades, and he got 10 years for trying to set on fire somebody's summer house, like a summer house of an official. It never worked because he got together with the provocateurs. But still, he's in jail, and we consider him a comrade. I mentioned promen.io website, right? And these people, you can see, they got like 5 years. Why? Because they were in the protest holding a banner with a link to that website. And since that website is a extremist formation, you cannot like link to them. So they got 5 years for the banner, and of course, like not for that. This was used as a reason, right? We all know that, but still, it's as funny as that. You might have heard of the anarcho-partisans group who got 20 years, most of them, and now at least two of them got one more year on top because they are unruly in prison. They don't want to. And also, like one of the guys who was on the run for 10 years, he got tried again for his previous actions. Most of these people have been moved or are in the process of being moved to the high security prisons and being in isolation cells. So it's not so hard, it's not so easy for them. And this is also an interesting case. It's 10 people. In the case of they were called anarchist criminal organization because what COPS did is basically they detained these people and used the protest repression as a way to trace back all the activities starting from 2014 of an organization that was called Revolutionary Action. And they did various stuff like symbolic direct action or, I don't know, closing the road, participating in the protests, making graffiti, like